Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to this bonus episode of Pulp Kitchen. This week, we released episode 104. If you haven't already listened to that, go and listen to it. We reviewed May, December and Saltburn. Mm-hmm. But today, on this bonus episode, we're going to be talking about, well, James, what have you seen?
I've seen Peter Jackson's Bad Taste.
Right.
A film from 1987.
I see.
I've also watched Bottoms.
Yes.
George, you reviewed it a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
You can go check out George's review. You didn't quite get on with it.
Well, we'll talk about it when we get to that.
And then also you and I have both watched part one of season six of The Crown, the first four episodes of the final season of The Crown. They've separated it into two, and we'll be talking about that. In spoiler depth, are we going to talk about it in plot details?
I think so.
I think we can.
I don't think there's actually
it's very little to spoil, but
don't know what happens, blimey, yeah. You're in for a ride.
If you are desperate to not see how The Crown tackles that issue, then maybe wait. But we'll be talking about spoilers for The Crown, and we'll probably pick up on part two as and when that happens. But George, in the meantime, Peter Jackson's Bad Taste. Yes. So a good friend of mine who you met called Amy.
Yes.
Who works in horror.
Yes.
Really great, lovely girl. She decided she wanted to start doing like this sort of horror movie night. She's a really sick, twisted taste in films. I went to a Halloween party at hers and she had projected on a huge white wall montages of some of the most like disgusting, horrifying scenes in cinema of like limbs and nudity and bone snapping. And it was kind of like vibey, but also deeply horrifying. And I found myself at one point probably just sitting next to the projector watching that horror. But anyway, she was like, okay, I want to do a horror night on a Sunday night. We're going to screen something on the lighter end of horror, which is not even technically horror, but it's gory. And that was Peter Jackson's Bad Taste.
Yes.
I'm a huge Peter Jackson fan, obviously, as everyone knows, from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I knew he had this sort of DNA thread of being this like gulpy, gulchy, literally bad taste type of horror. And I knew of the film and people had said, you know, it's very lo-fi, but if you go back and watch it, you can really weirdly see the DNA of how Peter Jackson likes to shoot things. And you can totally see that echoed in The Lord of the Rings. And Bad Taste is a total backyard camcorder lo-fi, literal backyard. We shot in the space we were with the stuff we had with the people that were around, and basically a bunch of scientists and a sort of like nondescript agent men stumble upon a town that's been emptied, and they realize that the New Zealanders are being harvested for an intergalactic restaurant by some aliens who seemingly appear to look like human beings but actually are not.
Of course.
I saw, I mean, look, you can, I've seen clips in the film and I knew the kind of vibe that it was.
I've seen the poster. Is it something you're going to show me with the middle finger?
There's that. There's all sorts of like imagery of like eating brains and.
Were you going to show me something?
No.
Oh, sorry.
Like taping skulls back together and eating vomit soup. And I sort of knew that DNA. I'd seen it in like some of the Lord of the Rings documentaries. And, you know, I think I saw it in the perfect environment, which is with a few beers, with a group of friends. Yeah. On a Sunday night with some pizza, laughing along and sort of enjoying it. And it stars Peter Jackson and clearly some of his friends.
Nice.
And in the credits, it was like, thank you to these people and mum and dad for supporting me. I think honestly, if you had showed me that and you said it was someone who wasn't Peter Jackson, I would never have thought, oh, clearly this is the beginnings of a great studio going to make one of the masterpieces of our time. No, what you do see is that it's a really wonderful, cute, grungy, squelchy gore comedy that has like loads of heart. It's incredibly lo-fi, camcorder, no tripods, but like really fun, really edited in a really fun way from someone who clearly loves what they're making. Some really awful imagery, like that, and actually horror-wise, some really creepy bits of horror when they do go into the house and they realize the aliens' plan. Loads of really fun action, very 80s VHS.
Nice.
Like some guy in the corner watching something. What is that? Oh, it's called Bad Taste. And totally, you can see the way Peter Jackson likes to shoot, decapitation, blood spouting. Yeah. You can just see that in the Lord of the Rings. But if you gave him $100 million yeah. and the best crew in the world, you can see where like that idea yeah. takes itself. Loads of really funny moments. And the charm is that you can tell someone has got a spoon filled with ketchup off camera and they are just flicking it. So am I like blown away by the film? Not necessarily, sure. But in getting to watch it in 2023 yeah. with the hindsight is a really heartwarming and endearing and just quite a fun experience. I would say if you're going to watch it, do as I did
yeah.
with friends and a beer.
That sounds really yeah. great. It sounds a bit like when I watched Evil Dead 2 with my friends.
Right, yeah.
And same yeah, sort yeah. of thing, like horror comedy, squelchy, yes. made for about £2.50.
Yeah. But yeah. even though it's like so low budget, the horror brainy bits when they come,
yeah, they work.
They look really disgusting.
Because they're real, they're tactile. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very very much like Play-Doh, like mashed potato with ketchup running through it. just good fun. Really, good. Really good fun. So yeah, it's if you're a big Peter Jackson fan, go and seek it out and have a good laugh with it. It's very, very good fun. Oh, and sorry, there's one thing where like, I have a really good idea of what Peter Jackson looks like, but obviously from the 1980s. There's one character that opens and I'm like, that's Peter Jackson, and he's shaved. And then there's another moment where Peter Jackson's in it and he's got a beard. I'm like, oh, that's Peter Jackson. Is that like his brother? Is his brother in it? And then I realized he just would have shot half the film for this character with a shaved face, and the second half would have been the other way around with a beard. Yeah. And it said in the end, Peter Jackson as Peter Jackson. As. I was yeah. like, oh, nice. Like, I really actually, despite knowing what Peter Jackson looks like, can tell that one of them was actually Peter Jackson as well. But yeah.
Okay, comment. Bad Taste. If you've seen Bad Taste, let us know. Hello at popkitchenpodcast.com. I quite like us going back to see a filmmaker's first work.
Totally, yeah.
Tracing it back to the source.
Yeah.
I've not seen Following. Have you seen that? Nolan's first
no,
film.
No, but it's like we the one where it's like, yeah, but have you seen Following?
Yeah, yeah. We should just trace it back the debut films of
that's
all of
his
them.
Black and white one. I've heard him talk about that, how he shot it in black and white because they couldn't afford lighting and therefore couldn't match white balances on a camera. And if you don't have any colour, you don't have to match white balances. So you just shoot black and white, which is a really great decision, but it's very artistic.
Bottoms.
Next up, George, Bottoms. Please go and check out George's review from a few weeks ago.
We did it in episode 100. It was a bonus for episode 100 because it was the same week we did Anatomy of a Fall, but we didn't put it in the main episode.
For someone who doesn't know or hasn't seen it, George, very quickly, Bottoms.
Comedy, high school American teen comedy, raunchy, raucous, zany comedy about two friends who set up a fight club at school with as a self-defense class, but really for the purposes of trying to sleep with cheerleaders they fancy. Mm-hmm. I saw it. I was really excited to see it. I was a bit disappointed. I just really didn't find it funny. I could see the jokes there. I just didn't find any of the jokes particularly smart or interesting. I just kind of sat there a little bit cold, frankly. But other people I know have loved it. James?
So, yes, you got this film called Bottoms, which very much of the... Sorry.
And was I right? They say Bottoms because they're the bottom of the school, they
yes,
say.
Yes, not a sex thing. Not a sex thing, which I really thought that was when you brought it up. It's co-written by Rachel Sennett, who also stars. It's kind of like how... Seth Rogen film is of the character. Yeah. You can see the sort of DNA running through it. My main take, I had your review in my head when I was watching it, which is kind of hard because it was not at all. It was like distinctive and I knew, I'd seen on social media some people really loving it and it has a really high sort of, a lot of people are holding it in very high regard online. So I was like, where am I going to sit with it? And when I started with it, you know, I watched it with Talia and there are moments where like, oh, we did really laugh and it's a little bit weird and some of the dialogue is really out there. And there's other moments where I really didn't laugh and that moment really fell flat.
But yes.
The main overriding thought I had watching it as this film being set in a high school coming out in 2023 is that it must be so hard to write an American teen high school comedy without making it as arch and as satirical as Bottoms is. Because I'm realizing like the American high school is kind of like a cast, it's like an old cast member that you're dragging back. It's like getting Morgan Freeman to do the wise guy who gives the moral of the story now. It's almost like you can't really do it without doing Bottoms. I'm not saying that's true, but I wonder if the filmmakers are like, we can't just simply do this without massively emphasizing all the elements that make a high school and subverting it with this completely out of off the wall idea of doing a fight club to try and sleep with or try and kiss the other girls in school. So certain moments really had me laughing, more so in the beginning. Then there are a lot of bits. Me and Talia both were just like,
straight
over. And it's not because I didn't understand it.
I saw the joke.
I got it. I get what it's trying to do. There is definitely a, I know these weren't made, you know, made at the same time. These were made at the same time, but I can see like the DNA of Barbie, the style of Barbie in there. And just parts of it really, really didn't get to me. I think it was very beautifully shot. I thought the actors were all having a good laugh with it. I do see the slightly sort of like improv style of comedy within there. I actually liked a lot of the visual gags, some of the posters up on the walls, some of the things that they'd done there. And I think it's okay. Yeah. I think it's a fun twist that I'm neither like, this is reinventing, refreshing the high school comedy drama, save, this is what they're going to be now. But I'm also not like, this is awful.
I think you're somewhere between me and the rest of the reviews. You saw it with someone as well. I saw it on my own.
Yes.
And I don't know. Yeah, I was a bit bemused, frankly. And I'm glad you see the thing. It's like, you can see the jokes there. It's not like you don't see the jokes. You can see the jokes. And they come and they just fall flat.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, yeah. Like, that joke's a joke. It's not that smart.
And I finished it. I think back to certain scenes at the beginning where I'm like, what really was that? And what's that scene there for? And is that now superfluous? Now we know the ending. It has that a really heavy inclusion of a low point, you know, in films really have to double down. Yeah. Like, what? You said this and it's all fallen apart. How could you do this? What, me? You're the one that did this and we have to separate so that we can all come back together at the end.
Yeah.
Which I know is structural of a lot of those types of films, but I did really feel like you're just doing the thing.
And they kept going on about that other school, which I was like, what other school? Yeah. What other school? And when the character's like, yeah, I've got a bomb. And I was like, that's a joke, right? And then they obviously like have a bomb. And I'm like, oh, but I thought we were doing like real drama about like really loving someone, but you've got a bomb.
Yeah.
What?
Like there's something like the presence of teachers is very selective. So I think you made a comment of like, there's this whole scene where you're like, where are the teachers? But there clearly are teachers there. But I think it's almost, I sort of looked at it as going, oh, maybe it's quite clever in that a lot of the scenes that are happening are like what a high school student's worst anxiety would be like for a day of school.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of like the worst nightmare of like, oh my God, imagine if that happened. Yeah. That's where Bottoms lives in. If this actually gets happened.
That's fair.
The principal says that over the megaphone. The person humiliates you in front of them. Like all the football players are always wearing their studs and their pads. They're like, they don't really have an identity outside of that.
Yeah.
Like there's something there that I think is quite smart.
Yeah, I see your point landing. Actually. I needed someone to say that to me, yeah.
You're welcome.
I'm glad it was you. Okay, so you thought it was okay.
It was okay. Enjoyed it. I know a couple of moments where like me and Talia both like heads back, oh, that's funny, but equally.
What was the funniest joke in it?
Like some of the visual gags with the things written on the walls. Okay. I can't remember specifically now. And like one of the bomb things I thought was funny.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember now.
Okay,
but like we got there.
Okay,
guys. As always, if you had thoughts on Bottoms and you still wanted to write in, please send in your thoughts to hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
And now we're going to talk about The Crown.
Yes.
Now The Crown is a show that we've spoken about in bits and pieces throughout the year. We did a bit of a discussion last year because we went to the season 5 premiere, which was a big affair.
Huge.
Because you know The Crown takes a year break between each sort of reset of the series, as most of you will know, but maybe you don't. The Crown, created by Peter Morgan, in its 6th and final series now, every 2 seasons they have rebooted and recast. Claire Foy and Matt Smith started off with the sort of 50s and 60s, Olivia Colman doing the 70s and 80s, and now you have
Imelda Staunton,
thank you, and Jonathan Pryce leading a many talented cast through the 90s and what the next part of season 6 will be, which will be the noughties. And I think our relationship, correct me if I'm wrong, James, but like, I think our relationship with The Crown has kind of changed. You and I hold the first 2 seasons in particular in very high regard.
I remember you and I talking about it years before we started this podcast and catching up and being like, oh, like, pleasantly surprised by
really
it.
Really surprised.
I remember really thinking it would be a Downton-esque caliber, which I don't know, I just never really got on with it.
But me neither.
Really pleasantly surprised.
Absolutely.
And I'll have a comment about that later. But
And I still think that Claire Foy was just impeccable.
Brilliant.
Just brilliant.
And Matt Smith too. Just...
A really high
together and telling the story of those two people and using history as a tool to enhance that relationship and really use like the iconography of who the Queen is, really sort of worked setting it that long ago and creating a relationship drama within that just had a really great melting pot. I thought it was great.
And presenting, you know, filling in holes in British history to a younger audience.
Things you'd forgotten and heard about. But
totally. And I think I said this at the time, which is like The Crown came out, seasons 1 and 2, at a just post Brexit referendum at a time when there was a lot of sort of like national identity. What is this country? What does it mean? And here comes a show that basically removes itself from that by being set in the past,
yeah.
but also is about the formation of the British identity, the current, you know, Elizabethan age. And I found that was just like really apt.
And sort of timed with like, you know, the Queen at the time of coming out, very much had coming towards the end of her life.
Yeah,
now since lost the Queen. And there was always this, it always had this balance of there's the history you know, but the conversation behind closed doors you didn't. Exactly. And it always was very good at not over-explaining the history to you, but like, here's what could have been said. And that was quite nice.
And then I think as the series progressed, we liked it. I think we both think that, bless her, as much as we like Olivia Colman, I do think she was a bit of a weak link in the seasons 3 and 4, unfortunately.
Not quite the heights of...
She didn't reach the heights of Imelda or Claire. Mm. I think that what happened to
Helena
the Crown...
Helena Bonham Carter too, not quite as good as Vanessa Kirby in my eyes.
I think what happened with the Crown and is that in terms of the structure of the show, as soon as from season 4 onwards, with the inclusion of Diana and also Thatcher as well, but mainly Diana, is that the royal story changes and it becomes almost a different show. It becomes the story of Diana and the royal family and not
Charles
royal family.
As well.
And it becomes, because that is just the story of what happened, it becomes a more melodramatic, soap-like kind of beats, you know, this sort of, you know, this couple in crisis, lots of screaming and throwing objects and that kind of thing. And it moves away from the kind of Winston Churchill, Claire Foy episodes we were used to from before.
It becomes very difficult to put the Queen, as we would maybe remember her in recent memory, in these overly dramatic and sincere scenes versus what it's like to put the younger ones now in these very dramatic scenes. It feels a little bit more difficult.
And also, we're getting closer and closer to when more and more into living memory. And also that the thing is with Diana as well, like this is the case of series 5, which you and I both liked and had some good standout episodes, but... you know, which, you know, focused more and more about Diana and, you know, the Newsnight interview. But it's like that story is so very recent in a lot of people's minds and also so tragic that often watching it, it left you feeling very strange. And I remember I finished season 5, I was like, good. But in the run up to this season 6 coming out, you and I spoke about it a bit off air. I was kind of like, I don't know where I am right now, because we know where this is going. Every time you watch it, you just feel this overwhelming sense of tragedy. That's something, you're watching someone's life slowly be ruined, and we all know where it's going. Mm. And then it brought us to season 6 coming out. And there was an article that the BBC ran, but doing sort of a coverage of what critics had said. And it was this absolutely excoriating, devastating article that said The Crown season 6 panned and savaged by critics, which actually they then corrected afterwards and said mixed review from critics, because it was mainly skewed by a 1-star review in The Guardian, which said like season 6 of The Crown, so bad it's like an out-of-body experience. Now, I watched the 4 episodes at the weekend, and these 4 episodes are entirely based in the summer leading up to the crash that killed Princess Diana. Yeah. And it predominantly focuses on Princess Diana. Other Crown characters are in it, but it focuses on her time in the Mediterranean, her relationship with Dodi Fayed, and her time in Paris before her death. So, but you and I have now both seen all 4 episodes. And in that context, the only thing we just said and the environment, James.
So like talking about it and like evolving through history, coming into this part 1 of season 6, my relationship with going in to watch The Crown had definitely changed. Mm. Whereas if you'd asked me coming into season 3, I would have been like, so excited. Can't wait for the recast, reboot, whatever. Coming into this, I was a little bit like, I need much less from this series than I think I did.
Mm. Do you expect less as well?
Expect less. Like, I'm looking forward to it. It's always very beautifully shot. There's always loads of really interesting, juicy scenes. It feels a little bit like I'm indulging in like a tabloidy reality show, which I don't know if that benefits it, but because I was a little bit easier on the whole show, I went in with, especially in the first 3 episodes, just very much enjoying the passage of time.
Yes.
Reminding myself of that moment through history. There's a really nice contrast between the Queen basically failing different people in her life and that all basically catching up to her, whether she was an insufficient mother to Charles, an insufficient familial presence to Diana, and those things all catching up to her. I think that's all very thematically very well done, and I can see where they're going to take that. The moments that I enjoyed the first 3 episodes, I think I just generally had a good time with it, but there was just towards the end, and it's the moment when Diana's ghost comes
not her
back.
Ghost. I'm sorry.
Not her ghost.
People said it not to us. It's not her ghost.
Whatever you want to call it. Like Diana coming back after the fact to have this weird moment of catharsis with Charles, Dodi, with his father. And it's when the first moment I was like, what are we doing here? And what's this show trying to do? And what's this show trying to achieve? Mm. And at some time, I think that there's an enormous dramatic sadness of Diana having her last scene with William and Harry. Mm. And I'm also just thinking, like, they're there and... Why are we doing this? Is this a weird moment for us as viewers to get... Like, I've started questioning, what's our relationship between entertainment and drama based on these real people's lives? And that's where I just slightly felt a little bit icky, a little bit off. It touched something a little bit strange for me. And that's where I was like, I wish you hadn't brought those characters back to say those things. There's something to be said about when you kill a character off of your show... There's something to be said about letting their last moment be their last moment and having that remain. When you bring someone back and have them say things that they never said, you kind of take the sting out of their presence being missed.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, but actually, I don't agree with you about episode 4. I just didn't mind that at all. Really? But the thing with Diana's presence, which I'm not going to call her ghost because that's what articles review, but it's not
her energy.
No, but it's not because I never took that to mean that's not Diana you're seeing. That's an extension of Charles's grief.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but
and the fact is that the actor's there delivering.
Yeah,
lines,
no, sure, yeah. But like whatever Diana says in that, like I only saw it as a projection of Charles. I never saw that as Diana. Like, I never saw that as them trying to resolve their relationship.
No,
I thought it was trying to. I got clear from that like this is an absence in their life, and Charles is surprised. He's grieving. The Queen is surprised to have actually suffered loss. They have actually suffered a loss in a bizarre way, and they're realizing that they are inextricably linked to Diana. I didn't mind that.
One thing I found weird. As soon as it happened, I was like, oh, because I forgot that the article about her coming back was coming. So again, I'm watching it very passively. And all of a sudden, I'm like, what are we doing here?
They maybe could have done it one too many times, but then they liked it at the end when the Queen looks for her, she's not there.
Yeah.
In the last shot.
Mel Staunton, really fantastic.
Yeah, I do, and I agree with you. I went in with low expectations and I was pleased. I do think the third episode, which is basically the night before she dies, is very moving.
Yeah.
I didn't feel icky. I thought it was quite humanizing and it made...
A good explainer of the story we've heard about press and paparazzi.
But also just like, this is taking something, a story building up to an event that the whole world knows, but... just creating a human drama out of it. So you've got it's about a mother. It's about two people really. Dodie is also
a huge role in this. Yeah,
yeah, and Dodie is also the maligned figure within a wealthy family, pushed around. And I thought it was quite. I was good. That episode was quite moving actually.
Yeah.
And I actually, even though that you had issues with episode 4, I thought the whole early part of that episode where you see the news spreading through Balmoral telling the news and sort of the breakdown and actually the way that, you know, they show the hospital and Paris and the conflict, and it didn't feel like a remake of The Queen, which of course is what Peter Morgan did originally.
I also quite enjoyed the way it gave, again, this, I don't know if this is true, this could be for the characters, but the way it gave context to Diana's relationship with the press when she was on holiday and how that exchange worked, and they actually sort of not humanized the press but sort of gave an insight for how that would work, because that's a really unfamiliar relationship to anyone else who's not been famous. I quite enjoy, because they portray it in one way, like very intense, very bland, but it's also like, this is how the functional part of media works. And I was like, oh, that's quite an interesting dynamic.
My brother made the point that I think one thing that often gets missed is that the reason Diana faced such overwhelm, I mean, she was pursued by the media all her life, but like so much in that summer was because that was the first summer where she was divorced from Charles.
Sure.
It's the first summer where she's not an HRH. She hasn't got the kind of royal protection. I actually came back when I spoke to my flatmate who we talked about the bad article, and I said, you know what, that's not bad at all.
Yeah.
I think it was actually really solid. I actually think it's better than some of season 5.
I agree.
I think Elizabeth Debicki is fantastic.
And she does really, really
she's
good,
really,
really
great.
Good job with it.
A really good.
It's a hard role to play.
It's incredibly hard. One of the most iconic figures in the past 100 years.
I thought Dodie Alfayed was really good too.
Yeah. Yeah. A really nice, really well played. I hope she gets kind of recognized for it. I need Dominic West doing a good cry. I liked the whole thing.
It's Young William as well.
I look forward to seeing the final batch now. I'm back in, and I agree, it's not back. I've accepted it's not the show it was before. It's not the same heights, but I do think that, like, I'm interested. I have renewed confidence in the way that they handle stuff. Maybe you don't as much. I have renewed confidence.
Just over that, like everything relating to it is good.
I've renewed confidence that they might actually be able to wrap this up in a kind of interesting way.
You know, there's a moment I liked, which is you talk about Imelda, the Queen, having that very emotional moment, you know, realizing, contemplating the loss. And then she has to give that speech with the gardens of The everyone like mourning behind her, and the speech is, as we know the Queen, as we knew the Queen to be when she delivered these televisual things, like very
dry, really.
Dry, like a monarch, yeah. You know, is, but on one hand, Charles is like, you need to be the mother to the nation. Mm. And she has this really fine line of still honouring how the Queen's delivery, but showing that inside she is mourning. I thought that's a really delicate balance to find as an actor, and you did it quite well, and as a show.
Yeah, I think I've always said as well that I've always thought throughout each successive season of The Crown that you always, it's building towards this. Every season or episode of The Crown features this kind of like, the system isn't working.
Yeah.
There are sacrifices, there are compromises, unsettled. People are left out, unsettled scores, and you kind of have a level of toxicity building up. And I've always thought that in a structure of drama, it's been building to like a reckoning. And then I realized that the death of Diana actually is that reckoning, that it's not just inevitable from us from a history point of view, but actually in terms of the drama, this is actually kind of what it's all been building to. It's this, you know, the walls are crumbling. This is like shook to their foundations.
The poster was a crack in the walls.
Literally,
the palace,
that kind of thing. Yeah. It's like, this is the reckoning you asked for, where the Queen got it wrong, was misjudged. Everyone's, you know, completely at odds with each other.
Yeah.
So I'm looking, and now I'm interested to see the second part of season six and how they deal with that in what is essentially the fifth act, you know, typical five act structure of this show.
One of the, like, on the Diana thing, and again, I just want to be clear when I'm talking about the characters of the show and the real life people. When Diana did die, one of the biggest criticisms of the Queen was that they stayed at Balmoral, didn't come to London, didn't say anything, they withdrew. And sort of the obvious thing is that their first thought was to be with those boys. And what I thought the show would always have to do was explain the Queen and Philip's and the royal family's rationale for not being there. Yeah. And I enjoyed them being sort of like showing them discussing, seeing the news as it happened, but they chose not to look at the news. Yeah. I'm like, yes, that's a really hard thing to do because you don't want to just be sympathizing with the Queen. Mm. And bear in mind, she only just recently passed. Mm. You want to show that. I'm trying to tell you what I'm trying to say here. It's like,
you want to give dimensions to that character.
Dimensions to it without being just like overly praising and overly monarchist. It always has been a good criticism.
Yeah, I never ever get the feeling I'm watching like raw propaganda. I've always thought it's just trying to give different dimensions.
But I just had this overriding feeling. I'm like, what? Why do we watch these shows?
I know. That's always been the thing with
The Crown. It's a little bit strange.
Particularly
for me.
Now it's more, like I said, now it's in living memory.
Totally.
So I think it's time the show wrapped up. And so I'll watch this final episode. And maybe we'll talk about it then as well.
Do you think that, you know, Harry and Meghan's whole saga, without going into it, but that being very much a consequence and a reaction to Diana's treatment by the press, and that essentially being echoed with Meghan, regardless of how you feel about Meghan Markle, do you think the show is therefore incomplete by not telling the story of Harry and Meghan and consequently the Queen's death afterwards?
I think it's too soon. I really do. I think you need to let...
I agree with you, it's too soon.
It's like the dust, not just the dust hasn't settled, but like the strands of the story have not been woven together. You haven't given enough time even for biographers and researchers to go out and discuss. That story is kind of still
being
told.
He's still not being invited for Christmas and all this stuff is happening
exactly.
Now. Yeah.
I'm like, that's for a show in 10, 20 years time. And, you know, a show could cover that in 10 years time and be one thing. It could cover it in 20 years time and be another thing. Mm. Cover it in 40 years time.
Oh, you know, someone will do the Harry and Meghan show.
Totally. But
nice limited series, I think.
I think I'm happy with it not going to... I think going further than I thought they would. I thought they'd just go to 2002, but they're not. They're going to go a bit further.
I look forward to part two.
And we will probably discuss it. That was The Crown, season six, part one. Let us know your thoughts if you've seen it too at hello@popkitchenpodcast.com.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to this bonus episode of Pop Kitchen. Don't forget, we post full numbered episodes every single Wednesday. We just put out episode 104. Next week, will be episode 105. What are we going to talk
Good
about
for
then?
You can
we'll
count.
See, yeah.
What
yeah,
are we going to talk about next week? Well, there's a new film on Netflix called Leave the World Behind with Julia Roberts, Mahershala Ali, and Ethan Hawke.
I'm going to go see a film called Femme, which should be quite good. Mm. Hopefully, you're going to enjoy that with George
Mackay.
I never get it right.
See you then.
See you then.